Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 63. People often say that motivation doesn't last. Well, neither does bathing. That's why I recommend it daily. Zig Ziglar.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's episode is sponsored by Scripthaven. Scripthaven is an online marketplace for aspiring screenwriters to have a platform to sell their content in a variety of formats, including short form, features, and TV pilots, in a simple, fast, and secure way with no barrier to entry. Scripthaven also provides a market for producers to purchase or option a huge collection of content posted by famous and not so famous screenwriters from around the world. Scripthaven is free to sign up and you can upload as many scripts as you like. And in January, Scripthaven is going to be running a screenplay competition for shorts. If you want to sign up, just head over to scripthaven.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Save the Cat. To help develop, tighten, and hustle your story, Save the Cat has launched year two of the Save the Cat Screenplay Challenge and an all-new Save the Cat story structure software. The Save the Cat Screenplay Challenge delivers 50 points of analysis for all submissions at no extra cost, and the Save the Cat story structure software helps guide your plot, organize, and structure your story. And as part of our new relationship with Save the Cat, we are offering you 15% off both the Screenplay Challenge and the Story Structure software. All you have to do is use the code HUSTLE and get 15% off. Just head over to SaveTheCat.com. Now, today on the show, we have Jeff Schechter, and he is a million-dollar screenwriter, director, author, and even apparently a programmer as well. He's an app entrepreneur. There's so many things that Jeff does. He's been around the business for a long time and has written just dozens of films for the studios, as well as created shows, been a showrunner, and he's the author of arguably one of the best titled screenwriting books ever, My Story Can Beat Up Your Story, 10 Ways to Toughen Up Your Screenplay from Opening Hook to Knockout Punch. In his book, he breaks down his screenwriting system and has been used to generate millions of dollars in script sales and in open writing assignments. And as you guys know, I love bringing on different authors, different systems, because you never know where you're going to pick up that little nugget, that little gem that's going to transform your writing and just make something click inside your head. So I always love hearing as many different theories and systems for story structure and character breakdowns and theme and subtext and all the other wonderful elements that go into the recipe of making a good screenplay. And Jeff definitely delivers in this episode. We not only talk about his early days in Hollywood and how he, his first writing assignment, how he got his first writing assignment, which was Bloodsport 2, which obviously if you're an 80s kid, you'll understand that reference, but also all the films he's done for Universal, for Disney, shows, and so on. And we discussed the one major tip that every screenwriter can do to have a fighting chance of breaking into Hollywood. So you'll definitely want to listen for that little gem. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jeff Schechter. I'd like to welcome to the show Jeff Schechter, man. How you doing, my friend?
I'm great. So good to talk to you.
Yeah, man. It's been, we've been playing Skype tag for quite some time, so I do appreciate
it. I know. Well, it's apparently between the two of us, you're the busy one. I'm sitting here like this for months going, when's Alex going to call?
Yes, I'm
and
sure
like,
that's
I can't
exactly.
Fuck a Schechter.
I'm a life. Obviously, that's what I picture all my guests doing. No, I'm joking. but when we logged on to Skype, you know, we're like, you know, brothers from another mother, because you've got all this amazing geek stuff in the background for people listening. Yeah. He's got Star Wars statues and Marvel statues everywhere, and it's just it's nice. It's nice to see that as well. So before we get into it, how did you get into the business?
Well, it was kind of one of those things where I always knew I wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, which was really, I mean, you know, I've got four adult kids, and they both asked me, like, when did I know what I wanted to do? Because, you know, they're all in various phases of some have figured out exactly what they want to do, some haven't. And I was like, I don't know. It's like, I don't remember a time when I didn't want to be a writer and didn't want to write for television. And, you know, so it was sort of just like everything I did, starting even in junior high school, going into high school. I was writing stuff. I was writing my own plays. I was directing them. I was making short movies, you know, with my friends in Brooklyn. And then ultimately came time to go to college. I just knew I was going to go to film school. I applied to State University of New York College at Purchase, so SUNY Purchase, mm-hmm. you know, where, you know, had back then, that was the late 70s. You know, there were the people who came out of Purchase were people like Stanley Tucci and Ving Rhames. Wesley Snipes was there for a while, you know, in the acting world. Directing, I think Hal Hartley, came out of SUNY Purchase, Charles Lane, Parker Posey was there. So, you know, there was a sort of an up-and-coming kind of vibe to the school, and just went through film school there, got out, had a great mentor at school who helped get me into editing. And so I worked in editing for a couple of years in New York while still writing screenplays, and then just moved to L.A. I read William Goldman's book, Adventures in the Screen Trade.
Great book.
Right? It's a great book. It's he had a chapter, the early parts of the book, before he started talking about his specific movies, the early parts of the book had chapters that were broken up like, you know, producers, directors, actors, right? You know, and then there's a chapter, it was called, you know, LA, and the chapter begins, and I'm paraphrasing imperfectly, but something like, I find Los Angeles to be a dangerous and potentially very harmful place in which to live. And I suggest that anyone seriously considering a career as a screenwriter move there as soon as possible. So, yeah, 23 or 24-year-old me reads that and like, okay.
Where's my ticket? Where's my ticket? Yeah,
yeah. No, seriously. Everything I had into a Buick LeSabre and drove cross country.
before I got here, I've been here about 12 years, and I lived on the East Coast as well. And friends here were like, the only thing you'll ever regret about moving to LA is you didn't do it sooner. And it's true. Once I got here, I completely understood what they were saying.
It's an industry town, you know.
But the whole town was built. Like I always say, you could take the film industry out of New York, and New York's still New York. You take the film industry out of LA, the whole infrastructure is built around the industry.
Right. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. It's like if you want to go into, you know, auto manufacturing, you probably still have to go to Detroit, you know,
or if you're, I mean, imagine if Silicon Valley left San Fran,
right?
The whole town would just collapse on itself.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that would be the time. Keep your eye on that, because that's the time to buy in Palo Alto.
Yes, exactly. Buy as much real estate as you possibly
can.
That's
a buyer's market, my friend.
At that point in the game. All right. So before we get into your awesome book, I need to ask you a very serious question. Bloodsport 2.
Yes.
Bloodsport 2.
The Citizen Kane of the Bloodsport franchise.
Obviously. I actually am not only a huge fan of Bloodsport 1 because I'm from the 80s, though I'm sure if I watched it again right now, I would not think it was the best movie ever made at the time. So it lives in my mind as what it was when I saw it. And when I saw that you wrote the sequel to that, because Bloodsport 1 was a fairly big hit at the time.
It was a big hit.
And then they call you up and go – And they call it
Van Damme. I mean, it was, yeah, it's one of those cult classics. I mean, I haven't watched it in you know, I don't know,
25
years, yeah, right. Something like that. But it's definitely one of the, I mean, I still talk to the, you know, the producer, Mark DeSalle, mm-hmm. who produced the movie. I don't think he directed it. He directed Kickboxer. But no, it was somebody else directed Bloodsport 1. Anyway, and, you know, he's still like, yeah, Bloodsport. Yeah, Bloodsport's still paying the bills. You know?
It's amazing.
It's one of those things.
And now, how did you get the call? Because that's a pretty big first. Because I saw it was like one of your first writing credits, right?
That was the first thing. That was the first like WGA.
How'd you get that?
It's a crazy story. I had an agent at that time who I was studying karate. I was a black belt in Taekwondo back then. And I guess technically I'm still a black belt, though. I could demonstrate one kick for you, but then you have to call 911 right afterwards.
Yes. In your mind, you're a black belt still. Like,
ooh, wait, let me do it again. Yeah, that was a good one. Okay, so I was a black belt, and I had just quit my regular job. I had a this was 89, I want to say, so maybe just going into 90, and I'd gotten out to LA in 84, so I was out here 6 years and writing a bunch of scripts and finally got a good agent and some good specs features. And then I was working like full time at something. I was managing the karate studio for a while, and then I was doing industrial videos, and then I was working for a sales company. I was doing these industrial videos and sales training, and the guy that I worked for had all these interesting business theories that were actually. Yeah, don't get no hate mail, please. But it was actually stuff that was distilled down from L. Ron Hubbard, who had a lot of business theories besides his Scientology stuff. Right? Mm. He was big to business organization. I mean, as you can tell,
obviously, because Scientology is a very powerful organization financially.
Right. Yeah, it's a super tightly run organization, right? So, anyways, so one of his principles that he had was that if you do something part-time, you get part-time results. If you want full-time results, you should do it full-time. So I felt that I had achieved as a successful part-time writer as I could possibly be. I had an agent. I was kind of optioning scripts for $1 or $10. I was able to go on meetings every once in a while, right? So I felt like for doing it part-time, I'm getting my part-time results. So I quit the job doing these industrial videos and decided to dedicate 6 months to nothing but writing. I gave them 2 weeks notice. The guy says, hey, look, we need some more time for this. So you can give me a month. I said, yeah, sure. Right. So that was like around Thanksgiving. So I give him the month. And in that first month, I write a script. I'm going, this is amazing. I knew I could support myself for 6 months, without having to find another full-time job. I'm going to support myself for 6 months, and at this rate, I can write a script a month, and it's going to be big.
That's the way it works. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, that's how it works. Right. So wrote that first script in that first month. Had my last day at work, and then right around that same time, started getting involved in Orthodox Judaism because I was conservative. Jewish, getting involved in Orthodox Judaism. I spent the next 6 months just learning about Judaism.
You were procrastinating as a writer. Shocking.
I was in religious procrastination mode. It was great.
So instead of Netflix, you went down the Orthodox Jewish route. Okay, fine.
At least I was able to say, yes, I'm procrastinating, but it's because God wants me to.
Exactly.
So the 6 months, so 5 months goes by. I've now like almost completely depleted my account, and I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna have to go get another part-time job, right? Which I wasn't worried about. I was single, living on my own. It was ramen noodles. I wasn't freaking out about it or anything. So anyway, so my grandmother at that time, did you want the whole story?
You can get to Bloodsport whenever you want.
I'd always been. Okay, I'm going to get there. But it's just you asked. So.
No problem.
So I hope you've learned your lesson about asking me any question.
Yes, fair enough. I'm seeing the pattern, sir.
I've lost track of where we were. Okay, let me start again.
Grandma.
Grandma. So grandma had always threatened to take me on a trip. She was not well enough to travel. She says, okay, here's a small bucket of money. Why don't you go on a trip? So I said, okay, I had friends in England, friends in Sweden. I'll go to, England for a week, Sweden for a week, and then I'll go to Israel for 2 weeks, and then I'll come back, find a job, and keep pursuing this as a part-time thing. I do my 1 week in England, and I literally am walking through the apartment door of my friends in Sweden when their phone is ringing. Right now, this is pre-cell phone, pre-email. Right, so their phone is ringing, and it's like, I apologize in advance to your Swedish viewers, but guten tag or whatever the hell they say in Sweden when they answer, they go, yeah, hold on 1 second. And they hand me the phone. They go, it's your agent.
What? They tracked you down.
You know, because I gave her my itinerary. She tracked me down and she said, there's an open writing assignment for Bloodsport 2. The producer had read one of my spec screenplays, which was sort of a cop, you know, a cop action mm-hmm. kind of screenplay. And he would like to meet you to see if there's a fit for Bloodsport 2. I'm like, I'm just starting the second week of a one-month trip. You know, will this job be available when I get back in 3 weeks? She said, no. I went, okay. So I said, I will come back in a couple of days, right? So I took literally whatever little money I had left from the trip and whatever money I had in the bank and bought the only ticket I could from Sweden on short notice, which was a one-way business class ticket.
At least you went in style.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, yeah. If you're going to go out big. So I got back to L.A. and met a couple of days later and just said, there's no way I'm not going to get this job. There's no way. I have to get this job. You know, I spent more than the money I actually even had. So I go to meet the guy, and you know, my Brooklyn accent is behaving itself well at the moment. But the guy I met with, great guy named Mark DeSalle, he's from New Jersey. So, and he has not gone through the pains that I have to get rid of the accent. So I sit down in the office and goes, yeah, it's really nice to meet you. I'm going, hey, it's nice to meet you too. My accent starts coming out and we're talking and we're joking. And we just immediately hit it off. It was just like one of those things where, you know, we just really clicked, right? And, you know, like, you know, two guys from back east and you know, some backgrounds and stuff. And so all throughout the meeting, where he's going, yeah, this is great. I really loved your script, but you know, I gotta talk to some other writers. And I'm like leaning in. I go, no, there are no other writers. Right? And this happens like three or four times throughout the meeting. Yeah, no, this is fantastic. But yeah, I'm still talking to other writers. No, there are no other writers. Mm-hmm. You know. And then so the meeting finishes. I'm feeling really good about it. But then I race over to the karate studio that I was, you know, been training at, because I had helped the master at the studio write some karate books, you know, which is, I think, also helped with the Bloodsport, obviously. And there was some picture in one of the books of like me doing this like 12 o'clock sidekick back when I could lift my leg over my head, not by force.
Right.
And I had a couple of guys helping me. And I literally wrote in the gap between my bottom leg and my top leg, there are no other writers, and ran it back to his office and left it for him with his assistant.
That's amazing.
Got the job the next day.
That's awesome. That's an awesome story.
It was a combination of, you know,
serendipity. You know, yeah.
Yes, yeah, serendipity. Two boys from back east. But I think the if I could presume to make a learning moment out of that incredibly long, potentially boring story, it's that I was just willing to do whatever it took to do it. I mean, literally, like, oh, I got to buy a $3,000 ticket with money I don't have to get back to L.A. Well, this is what I want to do. This is what I got to do. Right. So it played into this advice I had, that you got to be willing to commit. You got to, you know, a lot of people have, you know, dreams, and a lot of people have goals, and there's a difference between a dream and a goal, right? So, you know, it wasn't my dream to be a writer. I had a goal of being a writer, and this is what you have to do. That's what you have to do, you know, and you have to just suck it up and, you know, and put in –
Take the risk, because it was a risk. Like, you know, in general, it's a massive risk. So you had no guarantee that you were going to do it. And you were like, look, I'm going to lose the rest of my European vacation, and then now I'm also going to have to spend $3,000 I don't have for the risk. Also, it was a different time. It was a different time, and you know, I wouldn't do that today.
I was going to say that it's not like I was there. You know, I was what, 20. 29, you know, single, you know, right. My monthly expenses were maybe $1,200 a month. You know, it's like, you know, I wasn't, it wasn't such a thing. Like now, it's like if I was on a European vacation, a 1 month European vacation with my, you know, with my wife and my kids, and I get the phone call, you know, it's like, you know, I'm not saying, honey, you know, I'm going to go back to LA. You stay here.
Yeah. You know, I mean, unless it's Kevin Fahey, and then.
Then it's right. That's a much different situation. I did on a, we were on a cruise, you know, last summer, mm-hmm. and there was a showrunner position had opened up on a TV show, and I had to talk to the show creator, and it's a guy I knew. I didn't get the job, but like that's because like I'm in the middle of like, you know, the Baltic Sea or wherever the hell we were. Trying to do a Skype call with like international,
timing.
And he couldn't hear me. I couldn't hear him. Suffice it to say, I did not get the job. I did not jump off the ship, swim to shore, and take a plane back for that.
So let's get to your book, because you know one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show was in the screenwriting space of screenwriting books, yours definitely sticks out. By its title, My Story Can Beat Up Your Story. And it's a fairly violent title, sir. It's
I'm a man on the edge.
Obviously, sir. All that karate is seeped into your screenwriting from your blood sport days.
Just welling up.
So why did you write – first of all, why did you call it that? And secondly, why did you write this – what caused you to write it? Because there's a lot of screenwriters in Hollywood. There's a lot of people who've worked in television. I mean, there's thousands of them. But very few actually decide to sit down and write about the craft or try to pay it forward in mm-hmm. whatever they've learned along their journey.
Right. It's a great question. The desire to write the book came from – I'm a bit of a gearhead, you know, like a bit of a science, you know, not, I don't want to say science background. I think that's giving myself too much credit, but it's certainly a huge interest as an amateur in science and physics and, mm-hmm. and how things work. And, you know, my favorite fondest memories when I was a kid was getting, you know, some broken piece of electronics and attacking it with, you know, a screwdriver and just dismantling it and trying to understand how it works. So I've always was fascinated with how do stories work? Just how do I reverse engineer a story? And I had a friend, a guy named Gil Evans, who's also a writer, and he and I would have these conversations back and forth. You know, how about this? Oh, somebody has this theory. Oh, there's this 7-act structure. Oh, it's a 6-act structure. Oh, there's mm-hmm. 22 steps. Oh, there's the, you know, so we would just go back and forth and, you know, and try to figure out sort of the structure of stories. And I think the biggest aha moment I had was Bloodsport 2. All roads lead back to Bloodsport 2.
Obviously.
That I said, okay, well, you know what? I want to, you know, when I'm going to structure Bloodsport 2, let me take two movies, you know, get them from Blockbuster, put them in my, you know, handy-dandy VHS player, and just do like bullet points, you know, plot points, blah, 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 blah. So I did 48 Hours, and I did Lethal Weapon. Right. So I write it down. I wish I had those papers. It was kind of fascinating. So I wrote down blah, 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 plot points, 48 hours. And again, I had 44 plot points. I went, oh, that's interesting. Then I did Lethal Weapon, blah, 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 44 plot points. I went, whoa, that was interesting. Right. They have 44 plot points. And then I said, well, can I subdivide those? Was there a sort of a commonality on how those were laid out? Mm-hmm. Right. So I started saying, oh, well, the first section is kind of this, and the second kind of a 4-act structure with a dividing point. Yeah, you know, so things started making themselves known to me, and then I would bounce it off, you know, my friend Gil, and he'd be like, "Oh, this is really interesting," because I just read this book called *The Hero Within* from Carol Pearson that talks about the archetypes that go into storytelling, and then I started examining films with these from the lens of these archetypes. It's like orphan, wanderer, warrior, and martyr, and it laid out, you know, on those films. And then I started breaking down other movies, and you know, 43 plot points, 47 plot. It was all in and around 44. So I started thinking, geez, I'm really onto something here. So just for my own writing, for my own benefit, I just tried to codify it in some way, and that ultimately led to me. You know, I was kind of dabbling in programming at the time. And by programming, I just mean like database programming, mm-hmm. which is Microsoft Access. And I said, well, let me see if I can create for myself a little template that I could use for story structure with Microsoft Access, just kind of for my own, streamline my own process. So I did it, and we had this, like, you know, the four archetypes and the 44 plot points, and what's the nature of those first 12 plot points, and the reversals that happen after the end of Act One, and the central question that comes up, and just took everything that I had learned, by myself and in conversation with my friend Gil, and developed this kind of like interactive database that was sort of fill in the blanks, and you have a well-structured story, because the structure wasn't just working for Lethal Weapon and Bloodsport 2 and 48 Hours. It was working for Star Wars, and it was working for, you know, I was writing kids movies at the time. I was working for Dennis the Menace too, and and The Wizard of Oz, and it started feeling, you know, if I can, you know, in my spirit of self-aggrandizement, it started feeling like I might have accidentally stumbled onto like the unified field theory of story structure.
Okay.
And so I developed this piece of software for my own use, and then moved to Canada towards the end of the 90s. And because of the whole immigration thing, I couldn't, I couldn't work for the first 9 months for Canadian companies. So I'm sitting around going, geez, what am I going to do? I had still had some contracts from the States. I was writing a picture for Universal. And I was like, well, what do I do with all my extra time while I'm waiting to qualify for Canadian work permits? I said, well, you know, I had the software. Let me figure out how to distribute it. Right. So, you know, so that became like my side project. I was going to market this story structure software. But, you know, and as any good piece of software, you know, comes with an instruction manual. So I had to now write down the instructions for it, you know, which meant that I had to start explaining the theory behind the instructions. And so suddenly I had this instruction manual, which was like 50% of a book on screenwriting. So ultimately, you know, about 10 years later or so, I was thinking, you know, I should just turn this into a book, because everybody who got the software loved it, and everybody who was, would just even read the instruction manual would be like, wow, this is cool, you should make this into a book. Mm-hmm. So it started from my own, you know, lazy ass, you know, I don't want to think too much when it comes time to work. So it went from that to, you know, well, here's a structure I can use for myself, into, you know, something I could sell to others, versus, and then it just, they turned into a book as well.
So now you have the story structure. You have this. You've broken the unified theory, the field of theory. Right? You've gone to black matter of story, essentially. I am also an amateur science geek as well, a little bit. I understand. You started. I'm sure you've read a handful of screenplays in your day. So you've probably read a bunch. What are the most common mistakes you see in screenplays, and specifically from first time writers, but also from even experienced writers, people, just writers in general? Cause you know, look, not everyone hits it out of the park every time.
Yeah, for sure. No, nobody does. I think the biggest mistakes that, it's hard to say it in a way that's not offensive.
Be offensive. It's okay.
If a bad ear for dialogue, right? Or their ideas, you know, are not commercial, or, you know, to be harsh, they just suck, right? That's not a mistake. That's just
taste.
It may not even be taste. It's just, you know, you've hit the wall on whatever your natural ability is. You know, if somebody said, you know, what's the biggest mistake you see with amateur mathematicians, you know, and I'd be like, well, you know, my inability to do any sort of high level math is not a mistake. It's just, it's a limitation. Right. So stuff that can't be learned, you know, you're kind of just stuck with. So taking that out, I would say, oh, bad characters, or, you know, bad dialogue. I mean, everything can be improved, but, you know, you have to cross that threshold into something unique and different. But the kind of the unifying mistake that I see a lot is bad structure. Because part of what my study on the subject has shown me is that we are wired. We have a biological imperative for storytelling. And stories that are told in a way that our brains are physically constructed to understand have a deeper resonance to us than stories that come, that try to, you know, like if our brain has circular story receptors mm-hmm. and something's writing, you know, plot points that are squares, they're not going to get into our story receptors. And we've all had that experience. You see a movie or a TV show, and you go, I don't know, something about that really didn't sit right, where I didn't like that. I'm not even sure I can even enunciate why I didn't like it. I could tell you why. It's because the structure, some aspect of the story was trying to force its way into your brain, and it blew everything up on the way in. You know, and then your brain starts trying to churn and understand what the hell was that all about. And and it just leaves you with a very unsatisfying story experience. So the biggest mistake I see is people just don't understand structure well enough. And structure doesn't have to mean formula, right? Mm-hmm. I haven't done this exercise yet. I mean, I was crazy about the movie Parasite, but I can assure you that if I sat down and ran it through, you know, my understanding of structure and you know, the whole my story can beat up your story mm-hmm. approach to storytelling, it'll fall out in line. So, and nobody can accuse, you know, Parasite of being like a formulaic movie mm-hmm. in any way. So what structure does is it gives you a wrapper around which you can let your creativity and your innovation and your personal flair for storytelling shine, right? But you don't reinvent structure every time you sit down to write a screenplay.
It's I always use the analogy of a house being built. It's the frame. So you know houses are going to be houses. You can't build the foundation on top of the roof. That's just not. Right. You need, exactly. There is a basis of how you build that house, and it's always going to be the same no matter what you do. There's a foundation, there's walls, there's a door, there's a roof, right. Period. Right. What you do inside of that is where the magic happens. That's where the architect comes into play. That's where you could mm-hmm. do other things within it, but those basic building blocks cannot be adjusted because that's just the way it is. You can try to put the foundation on top of the roof. Let me know how that works out. and then you get, you know, some other movies that we will remain nameless, that try to change the structure up. And you're very right. Like you watch, you watch a film like The Room and you watch that. And obviously that movie is so far beyond any sort of the foundation is on top of the roof on a film like that. And also the dressings inside are all thrown around and everything. So it's upside down, but he's transcended. He's walked into the multiverse. He is now in another dimension and has now become entertaining on a completely different level for many people. And that's very rare.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's the analogy with the foundation and the roof and everything is a good analogy, because even like in my book, you know, like going back to those 44 plot points, it's the first 12 make up Act One. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that get really specific about. You meet the, you know, hero, villain, or stakes character, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very specific flavor. After you get past those first 12, like the remaining 32 are much more generalized. You know, it's like, you know, seven pairs of yes, no reversals. And I don't say, you know, in this yes, no reversal, the stakes for the tertiary characters increased by 14%. You know, it's like, I don't drill into it because that's mind numbing. Right. And, you know, and unhelpful. But the first 12 are super important. That's the foundation of the house. And then even within that, you know, it still grows. And I should just add, you know, that the my approach to storytelling is not like, you know, because as I would hear a lot, it's like, oh, so every movie has to, every movie, you know, it follows
on page system. On page 16, this happens. On page 18, that happens.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, I try not to get that specific, but it gets pretty specific, right? You know, so no, not there. There are a ton of really good movies out there that probably have nothing to do with my system at all. So my and this is, I know this is, you know, indie film hustle, right? So, you know, indie films, you know, can be a little bit more freewheeling, you know, and experimental than what I'm talking about. You know, my goal had been to be a Hollywood hack from day one. So, you know, so what I'm describing is a very specific, here's how commercial movies, you know, work. And you know, it's sort of a chicken and egg type of thing. You know, am I saying that, you know, all good movies or all well-structured movies follow my system? No, you know, probably not, you know. Do all movies that follow my system end up with good structures? 100%. You know, and then it's, you know, now you're stuck with your dialogue and your characters and
theme, you know, and plot and all that
stuff. At least we took the biggest stumbling block off the table, which is structure.
You know, there was one movie I saw years ago, and I haven't seen it since because it was so, I found it to be just absolutely horrible, which was, but it was a huge monster hit, which was Twilight, the original Twilight film. When it came out, it was such a big hit. I just needed to go see it, and I watched it, and I found it to be horrendous. And because the main villain didn't show up until 20 minutes before the movie ended. Like, there was no even conversation about this guy until then. It was all about the love, you know, the back and forth pining. And then I understand why it made so much money, because the girls that went to go see it, they wanted to do that. And it fed into that demographic perfectly. Right. But the villain, didn't show up until, like, literally 20 minutes to the end, he showed up. I'm like, am I the only one who sees this? Like, there was no antagonist for 80% of the movie. So I couldn't relate to it. So that rewiring thing that you were saying, it was like short circuiting my mind, was that. And I just kept seeing, like, why does everyone like it? And I'm like, okay, not everyone, but, you know, why was it such a big hit?
That's right. That's kind of like there's a two-part thing with that, which is that when doing my analysis of movies, I never do sequels or movies derived from pre-existing material, because you can't learn anything, because they have such a built-in audience.
Right? Correct. And there was the Twilight books, yeah.
Yeah, you know, if George Lucas, you know, released, though, I guess the Star Wars
was original.
Yeah, is getting a little bit, you know, long in the tooth, you know, at least, you know, as far as critical success, but maybe not, I don't know. But you know, if another Star Wars movie came out, you know, it's going to make a certain guaranteed amount of money no matter how bad it is. And I don't even, you know, it's got a built-in audience. So I find for educational purposes, you can learn a lot more from analyzing Toy Story than you can from analyzing Toy Story 4.
Right.
You know, which you can argue, Toy Story 4 may have, for all I know, maybe made more money than Toy Story
1. It did. Yeah.
So, right. So you say, oh, well, therefore, let me learn from Toy Story 4. No, it's got a 30-year built-in audience, right? You know, it's like...
God, is it that long? Jesus, it is. That I know. It's
pretty much. 95, I think.
Yeah, so like 25 years. Jesus. Yeah.
So it's like, so you can't learn anything from Toy Story 4. It's like...
Yeah. But Wally, you can.
Yes, exactly. Exactly correct. Right? So something like that. Right? Wally 2, you wouldn't be able to learn as much from.
I don't think it would. Right? I wouldn't see Wally 2, but yes. I would probably go see Wally 2.
The Revenge.
Yeah, Wally 2, the Electric Boogaloo.
So a lot of the, you know, whenever I, you know, I would, that was like another, you know, big, not innovation, but big aha moment for me was looking at, like, you know, I'd go through Internet Movie Database and look at the top 50 grossing movies of all time, but parse the list. So I took out sequels, I took out reboots, I took out anything that had any sort of brand awareness, and said, now, you know, these, and those top 50 of all time might have been distilled from the top like 300 movies of all time based on box office, because I had to get down to the 50 original movies, you know, the Liar Liars and the, you know, the Star Wars.
The original Star Wars. So let me ask you a question. So I always love asking about this because Avatar. Mm-hmm. Avatar was an original concept, original world, no pre-existing, fairly risky film to put out. And I argue still that there's only probably one man on the planet who would have had that opportunity. I don't think they're giving Spielberg $500 million to design and to, even, or Scorsese or any of these guys. So there's very few, very, very short list. But that movie obviously was the biggest movie of all time, arguably still is, based on inflation and all that kind of good stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to go back, Gone with the Wind was really the biggest one. It's Snow White. It's Snow White. Yeah, and you know, those kind of still did. But arguably speaking, it's one of the biggest cultural hits of all time.
Yeah, it was number one for many years.
Yeah, exactly. What was it about that story, which it did get nominated for Best Screenplay and mm-hmm. Best Picture, but the screenwriting community, I remember, just destroyed it because it's Fern Gully. It's Dances with Wolves. It's it's this and that. Like they just go back, and I'm like, yeah, it is Fern Gully. Yeah, it is Dances with Wolves. I mean, it is Dances with Wolves. But so, a much cooler version of Dances with Wolves.
Right. Did you ever see the analysis, the side-by-side analysis of Star Wars and Wizard of Oz?
No, I haven't.
It's fascinating. Star Wars is Wizard of Oz.
Well, it's the hero's journey. It's basically – It's the hero's journey. My favorite is one of the biggest franchises in movie history, Fast and Furious. Mm-hmm. What's that? That's just Point Break. it's Point Break. It's the literal story. Instead of surfers, they're race car drivers. Right. It's essentially the exact same story. Anyone listening, please go online and look it up. Point Break is the original Fast and Furious.
one of my first agents, infamously said this to me, you know, when I asked his advice about, you know, what should I be writing. He goes, I don't care. Just make it derivative and make it quick.
Wow. All right, so back to the original question, Avatar. What was about that film specifically that you feel, that story that caught on? Or like what going through your system, what is it?
Yeah, I think it was, first off, structurally perfect, character's journey perfect. You know, it hits, you know, undeserved misfortune, orphan, wanderer, warrior, martyr. You know, on a huge canvas, it was a cultural event, you know, which you can't
quantify.
Ever predict,
yeah.
Right. You know, look, you know, it's an imperfect analogy, but you know, you can talk about, you know, the Abyss.
I love the Abyss. I love the Abyss.
Yeah, I like the Abyss a lot. You know, the character stuff, but. You know, same filmmaker. You know, took us to another world we've never seen before. Also, fantastical creatures, and didn't do a fraction of the business of
different time too, different time period.
Yeah, different time. But you know, it was, you know, within 5, 6, 7 years of each other.
No, you know, no, it's not. That was in 1990, and Avatar came out in like 2000 and something.
This was 1990.
Yeah, because it was during my time at the video store. So yes, I remember when it came out. there's a short window of time, 87 to 93. I'm pretty much unstoppable with trivia, movie trivia. That's my sweet spot. I can knock it out there.
So what year was Avatar again?
Avatar was, if I'm not mistaken, was either Avatar. It was because Titanic was 97 or 90. Yeah, it was 97. Matrix was 99. Right. So Avatar was, I think, 2007. It was 2007, about 2007, 2008, around there, or a little less. All right, hold on.
All right.
while we're speaking, continue speaking, and I'll look it up.
So anyway, yeah. So it was such a complete journey into this fantastical world, and part of it also was a little bit of a dog and pony show. You know, it's like we've never seen, you know, creatures, you know, in that, you know, like that ever portrayed before as well as they were.
So right? It was 2009. So it was okay. All right. It was around there. So it's 2009. So, but the thing was with Avatar, because a lot of people are like, oh, it's paint by numbers. It's, you know, the story's rehashed as Dances with Wolves and all this kind of stuff. But the big thing that made that story go is that he, and I saw it when I was watching, it was like he hit every point perfectly.
Oh, yeah.
He basically made the perfect apple pie. Like, yeah. Like it's a recipe that we all know, but mm-hmm. he hit everything perfectly. And right. then you add on the spectacle and the technology and the event exactly. and all that stuff. And then it's an unbeatable combination.
Yeah. It doesn't, things don't have to be, you know,
complex.
Brand spanking new. Yeah. It's not, you know, it ain't rocket science. You know, no, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, like, you know, yeah, Avatar was derivative. Nobody's ever claimed that James Cameron was the most brilliant, dialogue writer, you know, in the world. He gets characters really well. He, you know, directs them, you know, effectively. You know, dialogue-wise, Quentin Tarantino is better than James Cameron.
Sure.
But Cameron knows how to paint on a very big canvas, and he hits all the beats. It's, you know, he made it derivative and he made it quick. You know, it's funny. I'm sure you've seen the movie The Big Short.
Of course, right? I love that movie.
It was this great. Was it Gordon Ramsay? I'm trying to remember. Who was the chef? No. What was his name? He just died. Very sad.
I forgot. Yeah, I think I remember. I forgot who the chef is, but yeah, continue.
Yeah, but anyway, but he's explaining, you know, tranches of, you know, short selling, yeah. Right? He says, you know, he goes, here's fish. You know, I bought it, you know, for the weekend crowd, but I have some left over. It didn't sell, so I can't sell it anymore as fresh fish. But I cut it up and I put it into the stew, and now it's a whole brand new thing. Right. So, yeah, you know, so derivative storytelling, it's like, yeah, OK, I'm taking some old fish, but I'm putting it into a brand new stew, you yeah. know.
But that's storytelling from the Epic of Gilgamesh. I mean, it's like,
well, that's, you know, whole, you know, Lajos Egri, you know, there are only 36 dramatic situations. Right. So you go, OK, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, and I think a lot of screenwriters and filmmakers in general, they all get caught up with like, I need to create the brand new thing. I got to create the new thing, and I got to create something that's never been written before. And the thing is that everything's been written in one way, shape, or form. All you could do is put a new twist on it or combine certain right. elements to make it fresh and new. And you look at – even if you look at Pulp Fiction, which is arguably one of the more original films created in recent history – if you look at it and you put it up against the hero's journey and the points that lays out, it hits. But he just, what was brilliant about that is he just changed the timeline, but the thing still hit, which is the yeah. genius behind that film. Like, it's right. like, it's yeah, beyond. No,
my favorite examples from Pulp Fiction, as far as like, how does it follow the hero's journey is, you know, towards the end of, you know, Act Two. Mm-hmm. There's you know the death and resurrection, you know, moment. You know death and rebirth.
Right? Yeah, Uma. Yeah, Uma.
Yeah. Well, that was part of it, but it's Vincent Vega gets machine gunned.
Right.
Right. In the bathroom.
That's right.
So right, and yeah. then the next scene, he's alive again because it's just the timeline was, you know, was the conceit of the movie was playing with the timeline.
And that was right? the brilliance, but that's the brilliance of that film.
That's the brilliance of it, right? That's what I'm saying. You know, people who feel like, oh, I can't follow the structure, I'll make it formulaic. I go, yeah, because in your formulaic hack, you don't know how to do it better. You know, hence my story can beat up your story. You know, I'm just a little too antagonistic with some of that stuff. I should be nicer.
So talking about
Snyder, you know, Blake Snyder was a much nicer person.
Just save the cat. Just save the cat. Don't beat up the story. Just save the cat.
Right. and he's a sweet guy, you know.
So we're talking about structure, I found that a lot of times I just saw a movie the other day that the hero, I couldn't identify with him. there wasn't anything really that really interesting about him. And I'm watching this cop drama and I'm just going, and he's a great actor and it's a, you know, and I love him and the cast is fantastic. And the production value is great, but 21 Bridges, the one with, Chadwick, Black Panther. And I'm watching it and I'm like, it's just so bland. Like his character had no real depth. There was no history to it. He was just like this. There was some, I think that the screenwriter tried to do something there with his dad and like he's a cop killer. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a killer of cop killers, as a cop and all this, but it wasn't anything good. What advice do you have for making, you know, for constructing a good hero? What are some tips?
Well, it's, you gotta go back to the sources. You gotta look at the hero's journey. You know, it's like, you know, there are a couple of, you know, a couple of like super handy kind of like
Swiss Army. Yeah. Like Swiss Army knife kind of stuff.
It's right. The Swiss Army knife. It's like, you know, I always ask these questions when I'm writing or trying to, sort of coach people with writing. So you start off simply. You go, what is your hero wrong about? You know, at the start of the movie that they're going to become right about, you know, at the end. Your hero's got to be the best at something, right? That's why, you know, you read it, you know, it's sadly, like you read a lot of screenplays or stories, you know, written by people and, you know, the hero's this like schlub, he's the loser, he's the joke at the office, he can't do anything right. You go, I get it. I know why you're trying to tell that story, but you know, it's, you're short, you're not giving the audience an in, you know, into the character. You know, if the guy's such a loser, you know, he's not good at anything, you know, then you're not
interested.
You're not interested. Yeah. What do you want him to accomplish? Right. So it's like, and then you have to put the hero through the paces of the journey. You know, you've got to make it really clear, you know, by the end of act one, you know, what's your hero's, you know, I think it was Sid Field used to refer to it as like professional, personal, and private, mm-hmm. right? It's a professional goal, right? What's his personal goal? What's his private goal, right? So with Luke, you know, professional goal is, you know, by the end of act one, professional goal is he wants to destroy the Death Star, right? Right. The personal goal is save the princess. Private goal is he wants to become a Jedi like his father. Right. And the way you can think about that is when looking at your hero and your main character, you're saying the professional goal is what's the thing that means the most to the most people that your hero is involved in. Right. Then the personal goal is what's the thing that means the most to the hero and a couple of his or her closest, you know, associates, mm-hmm. right? Allies or friends or family, right? And then the private goal is what's the thing that means the most to the hero, right? So it's just sort of a holistic way of looking at your hero's full life. And like going back to your very good question about like what are some of the big mistakes you see sometimes, you know, in a poorly told story, the hero only has a professional goal, right? Or, you know, or the hero's not, you know, not, you know, gives up on the private goal too soon, or the private goal becomes insignificant, right? Because that's how you know, that's the other problem, you know, that I often see a lot in the movies is, we've all seen it. You watch a movie and you go, oh, the movie's over. And you go, oh, no, wait a minute, it's still going on. Oh, it's still going on, right? It's like, yeah, the people don't know when to finish telling the story. Your movie is over when you've taken that, you know, go back to Star Wars, you know, will Luke destroy the Death Star, save the princess, and become a Jedi like his father? When you answer each of those three questions, that's when your movie's over, right? So and then the whole film is dedicated to answering those questions, yes or no. You know, it's like, he goes to Mos Eisley with Obi-Wan. So that's yes. By going to Mos Eisley, he will be, you know, he will be helping to destroy the Death Star. He will be hoping to save the princess, and he is taking a step closer to being a, a Jedi like his father. But they get stopped by stormtroopers, you know, so now it's all a no. And then it's a yes. And so that's why, you know, it's like, so then you start playing the reversals, but you got to know the question. You know, you got to know the question that's driving your hero.
So did you watch Office Space?
Not much. The movie?
Yeah.
I saw it a long time ago and then saw bits and pieces of it more recently. Okay.
All right. No, I was going to wonder, I was going to have you kind of break that character, the main character, because he was a schlub. But then I was like, as we're talking, I'm thinking, I'm like, well, wait, what is his professional goal? Well, his professional goal wanted to do this, and his personal goal, he wanted to get with Jennifer Aniston, and his private goal was to do. So he's like, okay, you start thinking about what it's
going to be. You know, but some movies just don't work. I mean, you can't break it down. It's like I took the liberty while we were talking about Jennifer Aniston of looking up how much the movie grossed, right? So the budget was $10 million and the movie grossed $10 million. Yeah. You know, so
but it built into this massive following afterwards.
True, but that's not the movie that's a movie that Mike Judge could make.
Yeah,
because he was coming off of Beavis and Butthead, right?
Yeah,
that's not the movie that you necessarily could make.
Oh, and that was also a different time.
Also a different time. You can't say it's a different time every time we talk about a movie that wasn't last week.
Because there's a different time. Like, our entire industry is so ridiculously different now.
It is ridiculously different because it's a different time.
Obviously, it's a different time, sir.
But, we would be remiss if I didn't bring up this point, which is that we're really talking about two different types of screenplays here. There's the screenplay that gets bought and then the screenplay that gets made. So, anybody who is an aspiring writer has to focus on the screenplay that gets bought, right? Which is very different from the one that gets made. So the corollary to that is there's the screenplay that doesn't get bought but helps to launch your writing career, right? So if you really want to get reductive about it, most people, you've written the screenplay. What's your goal? Sell your screenplay or have a writing career? Right? Probably having a writing career. Yeah, and selling the screenplay would be part of that, but it's not the exclusive part of it. Right? So there's all sorts of radical ideas. I mean, I go into it in the book a bit in the whole, the Smart Writer's Business Guide, where it's like ideally you want to write a movie that can get bought, right? So you got you got parts in there that it's like there's a somebody can read it and feel, oh, there's a star that's perfect for Brad Pitt, right? Or like you can see it, you can throw it in the description, hey, think Brad Pitt, but from Thelma and Louise days, or however you want to specifically say who this person is. But then the other side of it is, is you might also want to write something so outrageous and so unproducible. I know it's a weird thing to hear me, who just described myself as a Hollywood hack, say that if you're trying to break in, write something wildly unproducible, but make it super memorable. I mean, I remember sitting with a producer and we were talking about this because I think the meeting was over. I said, hey, I've just written the book. I'm interested in your thoughts on some of these things. And, and he said, yeah, you write something unproducible. He goes, somebody gave me a script once about a dog who wanted to commit suicide, but his owners didn't understand that this dog was depressed and wanted to kill himself. So every time the dog tried to do something, like it was like, like grabbing the toaster and trying to jump into the bathtub with it, the owners would be like, oh boy, are you hungry? Let me get you some food. Like they
it's brilliant. That's right? Brilliant.
It's brilliant. I promise you, if we have a conversation 20 years from now, and I hope we do because I'm enjoying speaking with you.
Yes.
So we have a conversation 20 years from now and say, hey, what was that unproducible movie I told you about? You go, yes, the dog who wanted to kill himself. I can't make that movie, but I never knew the name of the writer. I'm sure the producer, wherever he is, can still tell you the name of the writer, or at least remembers the screenplay. So it makes you memorable. It helps launch your career. I'd love to find out who that was.
Oh my god, I would so watch that movie. Can you imagine if it was a Pixar? Imagine if it was a Pixar animation.
Such joy.
That would be joy.
So there is a certain aspect of the business about write something.
It's really a great idea of doing that. I've actually read scripts from screenwriters who then got deals because of it was basically a writing sample.
Exactly.
I read a script about it was a mashup between Alice in Wonderland and Sherlock Holmes. Uh-huh. And it was this mashup, and I read the script. I'm like, this is completely right. unproducible, but it's very memorable, really good writing, tight. An agent of mine gave it to me one day to read. I was like, oh, this is great. Like, we can't make, no one's going to make this. And it was right before Sherlock Holmes got released and the TV show and all that stuff. So it was still a little early, but it's a little out there for the mainstream. But yeah. it's a great memorable piece. Now you do talk about one thing in your book that I wanted to bring up before we go is what is the unity of opposites?
The unity of opposites. I love the unity of opposites. It's my favorite thing in the whole world.
Yes.
It's this idea that it's and I didn't even invent it. I wish I did. But it's this principle that characters are connected at some thematic level. And they represent opposite sides of a moral or thematic argument. So, you know, so it ties very cleanly into theme. I mean, we'll go back to Star Wars, I guess. It's like if you imagine like a wheel, right? And you put Luke as the hero in the center of the wheel, right? The villain is actually not Darth Vader in that piece. It's really, Peter Cushing's character, because Vader works for him. So he's the big bad guy, right? So, and then you create these characters that go around Luke, right? So Luke and the villain, so the hero and the villain are connected on this thematic line. And for Star Wars, the theme is what's more powerful, faith or science? Faith or technology, right? Because that's this whole thing. Shut off the targeting computer, Luke, right? He does, and destroy, right? So that's the theme, right? What's more powerful, faith or technology, right? Then you have the unity of opposites. So you have two, six characters circling Luke, right? You have at the top, you have Obi-Wan and Darth Vader, right? They're connected because they're both old Jedis. They've trained together. They understand the power of the Force, right? But they're opposites, right? One's the dark and one's the light. So, and if you ask them what's more powerful, faith or technology, if you asked Obi-Wan what's more powerful, he'd say faith. If you ask Darth, he'll say, well, faith's really important, but technology is what's keeping me alive. And, the Death Star is this big ball of technology, not big ball of faith, and that's where he's currently working. Right. So it's like, so he's representing technology. So Luke goes, oh, geez, I wonder what's more powerful, faith or technology. He taught, he understands from Darth and he understands from Obi-Wan. There are two perspectives. Right. Mm-hmm. Then on the other, on this side of Luke, you have Princess Leia and you have Han Solo. So these are young, self-actualized people. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you ask Leia, what's more powerful, faith or technology? She'd go with faith, right? Trust, help us, Obi-Wan. You're our only hope, right? She has faith that, that people will do the right thing. You ask Han Solo, what's more powerful, faith or technology? He's going to say technology. Hokey religions are no match for a blaster, kid, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And technology. Then at the bottom, you've got the last two of your hero's main characters, and that's C-3PO and R2-D2. Right. Now, both of them are, are big chunks of technology. Right. But you ask C-3PO what's more important, what's more powerful, faith or technology? He'll tell you technology. Right. He has no faith. Right. Versus R2-D2, which, is going on missions and, he's got to help the princess. He's the best friend character. Right. So the unity of opposites. So these, you have two robots, are connected. It's the unity, but they're opposites. You have the two self-actualized young people, older than Luke, but younger than Obi-Wan and Darth, opposites, but, there's a unity to them. And then you have Obi-Wan and Darth, opposites, but there's a unity to them. And it's all about the theme. So the thing I love, going back again to the question of, what are the mistakes? I say, in screenplays, the themes are muddy. You don't know what's your story really about. What's the argument? What's the thematic argument that the villain is making? What's the thematic question the hero is asking? What's the thematic synthesis? What does the hero learn about the theme by the end, right? So Unity of Opposites is a cool way of identifying your characters, but also tying it to the theme, which becomes super important.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
Don't write a screenplay.
Okay.
Yeah. TV. Write an original pilot. Don't write a spec episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Don't write a spec episode of 9-1-1, right? Because you're never gonna match what 9-1-1 can afford the best writers in the business, and they all sit around together and they bounce ideas off each other and they distill out an idea. So you versus the entire writing of the room at 9-1-1, you're never going to write a script even close, right? And if you do, they're never going to buy it. And if they, if they really are somehow impressed, maybe you get a job there, but you're not going to get a job elsewhere because it's 9-1-1. So if you don't get your 9-1-1 job, you got nothing, right? You write an original pilot, 1-hour drama, right? You write an original pilot. They have nothing to compare it to. So already, it's not like, well, it's not as good as our 9-1-1 script. It's not as good as our original pilot. No, it's an original pilot. If it's really good, people will pay attention to it. You might accidentally sell the damn thing, right? Because if it's any good, and it's a solid writing sample, right? There's so much, so many more opportunities in television, and it keeps growing. I mean, number of original movies that get made. I mean, so go to the Internet Movie Database right now. Go to the homepage. Let's see, films in development, Thor, it's a sequel, Jurassic World 3, sequel, Fast and Furious 10, Reina and the Last Dragon, I don't know what that is. Oh, DreamWorks must be based on material.
Animation.
Bad Boys 4, sequel, pre-production, Doctor Strange, Guardians of the Galaxy, Last Duel is an original, Shang-Chi, Legend of Something, Mission Impossible 7. It's like, in production, Minions, Suicide Squad, Batman, Matrix 4, Avatar 2.
They're all...
Right. This is all material you can never get your hands on, you can't get access to, but you come up with an original thing. Oh, my point was, movies are going for big tentpoles and just the budgets have gotten so big. But TV, you can come up with something kind of new and interesting and different,
And get in. Have a fighting chance.
And you can actually, in TV writing, you actually have a trajectory. I can get in. I will start. My personal assistant on my last TV show, Stitchers, a guy named Matt Cain. He worked for a season as my personal assistant. They worked for two seasons as my personal assistant, producer's assistant. Second season, I said, hey, you're a really good writer. Let's work on it. Why don't you write a script with me? So I got him script writing on the second season he worked with me. He just texted me last night that he's officially in development with Netflix on an original pilot that he wrote, right? That's a trajectory, right? You have a TV, it's a trajectory. Film, it's a never-ending series of winning the lottery, right?
That's a really great way of putting it.
So TV is such a better business. And to be candid, I think the best writing is in television. It's not in films anymore, right? People who know these things have said that if you didn't – like whatever that Metacritic kind of algorithm that you have to look at to say, oh, here's a good TV show. By all objective standards, this is considered a quality television show. Mm. That there are so many of those shows that have crossed that threshold into being a quality show that there are no longer, for the first time in history, there aren't enough hours. If you did nothing, including sleeping, eating, and pooping, and you did nothing but watch quality television shows that are objectively considered quality, you couldn't watch them all. And more and more coming out every week.
Oh, no, it's impossible.
Best writing is television. So you want to break into the business, don't write screenplays. Write a 1-hour drama. Original, not a spec you know, 911 or Game of Thrones.
Very great advice. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Wow. The lesson that took me the longest to learn is that I don't know everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm still learning that because I have a problem that I actually do think I know everything.
We are in the film business, so this does happen.
I can't possibly know everything, yet I still think I do. So, you know, I'm still grappling with that. And I know I don't know everything, and I'm being a little bit tongue-in-cheek. But, you know, but it's – I think to try to make it – make me sound like less of a moron and you know, more thoughtful about it. You create something brand new, right? A script, a pilot, whatever. You have to – be willing to believe, I think, that nobody understands it the way you do, right? But you also have to be willing to think that people can help it. And the lesson is try to figure out, where do I get the help that I need versus how much do I hold on to what I think it is? And it's a particularly challenging bit of math if you become a showrunner. Right, because as a showrunner, you know, you're responsible for everything, and I know we're talking about television again, but the idea is that as soon as you start, you know, as soon as you start making changes that you don't agree with, right, just based on, you know, there's politics involved, it's studio notes, it's, you know, notes from your partners, but as soon as you start making changes that you don't feel, right, then you become useless to the entire endeavor because, you know, you don't know, you know, if you pitch me an idea for an episode of our show that we're working on, mm-hmm. and I'm a showrunner.
About the suicide dog by a suicidal dog.
Exactly. Right. Right. You know, you pitch me an idea. I can react instinctively and go, I don't know, that's not sitting well with me. You know, wherever this pilot or this TV show came from, that idea is not living in that same space. I could try to elucidated, or let's just reject it and come up with something else. So that's me thinking I know everything and rejecting help of good ideas coming in. So you have to be able to figure, to kind of parse that calculation, mm-hmm. is how much do you defend your material like it's your own child versus how much are you willing to look at it and go, yeah, my kid could use a little therapy.
Fair enough. And you three know, of your
that's the hardest lesson, I think, for me personally.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Ooh, they're favorites for all sorts of different reasons. Star Wars, because I saw it and said, oh my God, you know, I was 17. It was like, it was just such a complete journey and trip. That was pretty amazing. 2001, yep. You know, 'cause I saw it in my teens and I was like, wow, that's, you know, film can tell a bizarre, is it linear, non-linear?
It's Kubrick. It's just Kubrick.
Right. You know, and then probably, you know, for historical reasons, Citizen Kane, because it showed, you know, it showed what you could do if you didn't listen to anybody, you know, and you just ran with it. And, you know, then the movie almost, you know, killed him.
Yeah, very much so.
But it's Citizen Kane. So some movies I like for, like, you know, like Leo, you know, like it because they really touched me. I mean, there's all sorts of movies, you know, Forrest Gump, right? You know,
stuff yeah, there's
like
that. So many. All right, then where can people find you, your work, and your book or books?
Book is on Amazon, okay. You know, My Story Can Beat Up Your Story. I do have a poorly used website, you know, which is mystorycanbeatupyourstory.com. But if we have a moment or two, I'll make a plug for a brand new venture that I'm involved in where I've started a company and we've put out our first product called Writer's Room Pro, which is taking dice cards, cork boards, and the handwritten whiteboards mm-hmm. that are commonly used in every writer's room and saying, this is nuts that this hasn't shifted over to a digital equivalent. I know why it hasn't, because the price of the big monitors used to be too expensive. It's not anymore. So the time is now right for writers' rooms to, you know, like editing switched over from, you know, from film and trim bins, Avid and cameras switch over from film cameras to, you know, to digital cameras, it's time for the writer's room to switch to a much more secure, much more robust solution. So that's the new venture. So it's check it out at thewritersroompro.com. And it's really designed for professionals, but we have a lot of individual writers who are using the whole system. And it's not a story system, right? It's not, we're not trying to teach you, here's how you do it. Here's how you plot out a television show. It's really, it's just, if you could put it up on a board with index cards, but you wanted to make it searchable and you can output everything and import it into Word and Final Draft. And
stop it. And stop the madness. Stop the madness.
Right. So that's the thing I'm kind of most excited about these days, you know, as a corollary to my TV business. So writersroompro.com.
I'll put that all in the show notes. Jeff, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It was so great talking to you too.
I want to thank Jeff for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so, so much, Jeff. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, just head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/BPS063. There you'll have links to his book and other links we discussed about in this episode. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com. Leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out in the rankings on iTunes. Leave a review, rate the show, let us know what you think. I really appreciate it, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.